You're listening to Black Op Radio.
I recently pointed out in From the Wilderness, my newsletter, that people were scratching their heads as to why President Clinton would pardon the FALN guerrillas from Puerto Rico, who were in prison in New York for bombings back in the 1970s. And then I pull out a map and I show people that with the Panama Canal back in the hands of Panama, the closest military bases to Colombia from which to stage an invasion of Colombia or any sustained military action are, in fact, in Puerto Rico. So that in preparation for ground involvement in Puerto Rico, President Clinton probably cut a deal with FALN separatist guerrillas, because Puerto Rico is very much a Latin American nation. Spanish is the predominant language there. The people there identify more with Colombia than with the U.S. was that the president secured guarantees that if we stage military personnel in Puerto Rico, you won't have terrorist acts directed against the bases. And these are the kind of things you have to think about beforehand, before you start preparing for military involvement. And I really see that coming in Colombia.
Sounds like they're really on the ball then, if they're getting prepared that far ahead of time.
Yeah.
Do you have any... Oh, sorry.
You're seeing more right now in terms of the Navy and the island of Vieques trying to clear the eastern end of the island, which is, I think it's about 28 miles long, and the eastern half belongs to the U.S. Navy, but it's been occupied by native Puerto Ricans for quite a while, so the Navy couldn't use it for a bombing range, and the Navy is moving very strongly to do that now, and one of the reasons that my sources tell me why this is happening is because Puerto Rico is absolutely essential to any U.S. military involvement in Colombia.
Well, no. Prisoners and freed people, I have to ask, what about Noriega?
Well, I predicted from the wilderness, my newsletter predicted a year ago, that Manuel Noriega would be a free man before Bill Clinton left office. And I based this going back to, you both may remember the Gary Webb stories of the San Jose Mercury News from 1996. Which talked about Danilo Blandón and Norwin Meneses, two major drug dealers working for the Contras, being tied to the CIA and supplying L.A. drug dealer Ricky Ross with tons of cocaine. Those stories created a national furor in an election year, 1996. We had Maxine Waters running all over the country doing town hall meetings. Well, what was not known by a lot of people is that Gary Webb was fed the material that started him on that investigation, federal grand jury transcripts, by a woman named Coral Baca, who is the wife of Carlos Lader, who was one of the three co-founders of the Medellin cartel. We had the wife of a Medellin cartel co-founder giving Gary Webb the information to start those stories. Now, he didn't know at the time, I don't think, who Coral was, and Gary is a subscriber to my newsletter, I should add. But what happened is that Carlos Lader was imprisoned while George Bush was president and sentenced to 99 years. And at the end of the Reagan-Bush years, because the Medellin cartel had enormous amounts of damning information on George Bush and the Bush family and the CIA drug dealing during the Contra War, they allegedly had evidence, and I have written about this, linking both of the Bush sons, or two of them, Jeb and George W., to cocaine use, blackmail evidence on George Herbert Walker Bush, the vice president, that we saw at the end of the 80s and the early 90s an absolute massacre of the Medellin cartel. Pablo Escobar was ultimately killed. Jorge Ochoa was forced to go into hiding. They captured Carlos Lader, sentenced him to prison, and finally George Bush invaded Panama and ousted the Medellin's best friend, Manuel Noriega, and put him in prison for, I think, 40, 50 years was the sentence. Well, what we saw was Bill Clinton, the Clinton faction, has released Carlos Lader from prison in 1994, late 94, early 95, and sent his wife to Gary Webb with information that started a scandal that resulted in volume one and volume two of a CIA's Inspector General report. Volume two absolutely destroys George Bush and Ronald Reagan and the Bush CIA, Reagan-Bush CIA. That is a public document. You can access that from my website at www.copvcia.com, and I sell extracts for that. I have a complete e-store of merchandise there. And that report, Volume 2, you can get it off the CIA website. It's 450-some pages. You can you can read it, and what you see is that the CIA admits to having protected 58 known narcotics traffickers, keeping six out of prison. If you read the CIA report closely, it says that Oliver North was opening bank accounts for a company called Setco, which was moving 4 tons of cocaine a month. This is the CIA's own documents. Another passage says that Moises Nunez, a guy moving 200-plus kilos of cocaine a week, was caught with 200 kilos. The CIA talked to him, and CIA headquarters said, don't debrief the guy, he's working for the White House. Now, why would the CIA release this report? Well, the reason is very clear, is that Bill Clinton called his director of Central Intelligence, who works for him, George Tenet, who was appointed by him, and said, declassify a version of Volume 2 that destroys the Republicans. And that version was made public on October the 8th, 1998, 1 hour after Henry Hyde's committee started the impeachment of Bill Clinton. So taking this Noriega question a step further, what Bill Clinton has done is blackmail George Bush and the Republicans, that's how he got out of the impeachment, with the evidence of CIA drug trafficking. Then he is setting up a parallel drug network, which is running through the Dominican Republic, and this was the last cover story in From the Wilderness that just mailed about a week ago. And I have directly tied Dominican drug lords protected by the CIA into Al Gore fundraising right in New York, in the heart of New York City, through Charles Manatt, the former DNC, who is now DNC chairman, who is now the ambassador to the Dominican Republic. And I can make this all very simple for you. Basically, what's happening is the Clinton faction is setting up a parallel drug money network to fund their presidential campaigns to match the fact that the Bushes have won in Florida and Texas. Now, let me say this real, this is real simple, and once you get this, I think you get everything else. The four largest states in the United States for the smuggling, the importation of drugs are California, Florida, Texas, and New York. The four largest states responsible for laundering most of the $200 to $250 billion in drug money that passed through the economy as a result are California, Florida, Texas, and New York. And 80% of all presidential campaign donations come from California, Florida, Texas, and New York. And with the Bushes governing Texas and Florida, there is absolutely no mystery as to why Hillary Clinton needs New York.
Right. You know, I must say, though, it seems suicidal in a way to release information, even if it's not incriminating Democrats, because anybody who looks deep enough can start to find that this is a large web of, well, connections, really, and it goes on forever. You can dig into the Republican Party and you'll come up with Democrats. And okay, sure, this one issue might be Republican, but you know, these guys are all in the frying pan if this thing blows up.
Oh, there is no right party and wrong party. Don't get me wrong. I have never said that. I don't believe that. I both parties are thoroughly corrupt. As a matter of fact, my point is that if you don't play with drug money in this system, you can't play at all. That's the point.
I think what I was getting at, though, is that for Clinton to go after the Republicans using this kind of a tactic must show that he's desperate.
He was absolutely in a scorched earth mode. He was saying, in effect, remember, he released the declassified version of Volume 2 an hour after Henry Hyde's committee voted to start the impeachment. His message was clear. If you're going to impeach me, I'll bring down the whole government.
Right.
He had nothing to lose at that point.
So how far does it take for somebody else to end up in that position and the house of cards comes down? To me, it just seems like a matter of time.
Well, I think that this presidential election is going to get a lot more serious. This is a fight to the death this time. There are huge changes taking place in the world and in the world economy. These two factions are locked in a death match of sorts, and one must emerge, I think, the clear winner. Clearly, Bill Clinton has escalated, or let's say taken the clothes off of presidential wrongdoing. He's a much better street fighter, in my opinion, than George W. Bush is. But what we want, at least what I want, what From the Wilderness wants, What we write about in the newsletter is getting a map that says this is a system which cannot sustain itself. The facade is crumbling. The illusion that we live under the rule of law is fading away. I mean, we just had, you know, an expert for Waco murdered. You know, it's how many more plane crashes and accidental deaths, so-called accidental deaths, does it take before the veneer strips away and we see that we're living in a society of organized crime anyway? Then the people may say, well, wait a minute, we are on the Titanic. Let's find an alternative mode of transportation before the ship sinks.
Right. People are pretty reluctant to change, though. They need this sort of thing in their face, and it's pretty hard. The media seems sewn up. I appreciate you seem to be getting a lot of attention from people who might otherwise not listen.
Right. Well, you know, I have been at this for a long, long time. I'm 49 years old. I started when I was 27. And I can tell you that things have changed dramatically. I mean, when I have 700 subscribers, and of those 700 paid subscribers, four of them are network-level news producers, two are national-level print correspondents, 10 are members of Congress. What that tells me is that I am telling them information. I'm giving them a good map. You know as well as I do the difference between reading a good map and a bad map. Nothing makes you more frustrated than looking at a map and saying, I'm supposed to be at 35th and Main, and you look up at the street sign and it says 5th and Broadway, and you get real upset. On the other hand, when you have a map that tells you how things work, you feel more confident. So I see things changing because the number of people who are really aware of the fact that mainstream media is just selling them lies is growing. I mean, there's a market for this now.
Even within the media, it's starting to backlash. I mean, if you listen to your average radio talk show host, I mean, this is just the impression I get, but a few years ago, they seemed a lot more ready to walk these lines. I don't know how things are there with, you know, but here in Vancouver, we've seen protesters beaten up and, you know, weird stuff go on that you don't expect to find in a democratic country. And, you know, some of the people who fought in the world wars for freedom are starting to step back and go, just a minute, is this what we were
exactly
fighting for?
Well, you know, this is going to change. There's an old paradigm called the 100th monkey. It's an old story about how they were doing nuclear tests in the Pacific after World War II, and they nuked an atoll, Kwajalein or some atoll, and they tried to repopulate it some years later with monkeys. The problem was that all the coconuts had radioactive skins. Now, they taught some of the monkeys to wash the coconuts, and those were the ones who would survive. And, you know, so they had 20 monkeys or so out of thousands who were washing coconuts, and pretty soon it was 25, and pretty soon it was 30 who were washing coconuts. But then the scientists watched, and one day when the 100th monkey started washing his coconuts, all of the monkeys started washing their coconuts. Something happened at the collective consciousness level, and something just snapped in people, or people became aware. We don't know where that threshold is with us, but I think we live certainly in a time when the credibility of the government and the major media is not what everybody would have you believe it is.
Right.
Yeah, especially CNN.
Yeah. Most people don't know that CNN, for its satellites, uses military satellites. So the military can pull the plug on CNN anytime they want to.
Well, I just heard something about the military satellites being used for all these vehicle tracking systems.
Yes.
And they, of course, can jam them if there's ever an emergency and a need to, but also makes you wonder, though. I mean, not that they couldn't track everybody anyways, but are we just, like, giving them our freedom? I don't know.
Well, you know how Genghis Khan won most of his battles? And this is kind of interesting. Genghis Khan would have his army send spies out, and he would have the spies infiltrate the next territory that he was going to invade. The spies would get all the customs and the mores and how the people dressed and what food they liked and how they spoke down. And then he would take two or three of, or, you know, two dozen of his spies, and he would deliberately beat them up, but he would dress them like the people he was going to invade. And he'd beat them up, and he'd cut one guy's ear off, and then send them running ahead, and they'd go screaming into the village, Genghis Khan is coming, Genghis Khan is coming, he's horrible, he's horrible. And then Genghis Khan would arrive, and the territory would just surrender. You know, there are 270 million plus people in this country, and if you just think for a minute, It would take 270 million people to watch 270 million people.
Right.
They can't watch all of us.
Right.
You know? But yet that psychological warfare has been played on us systematically like you cannot believe. Going back to, I remember the Crime Bill of 94. When that passed, everybody was going down here, oh my God, the UN's going to be occupying Cleveland in February 95. You know? And we've been through this time after time after time until people just get desensitized to it. And all these stories about HAARP, and sure, they have all these, you know, great exotic weapons. They have them. But they don't, in the whole United States Army right now, there are only 30,000 guys with the MOS, the Military Occupational Specialty of 11 Bravo, which is infantrymen. There's only 30,000 riflemen in the whole U.S. Army. Now, how do you control 270 million people with 30,000 riflemen? Psychologically is the only way you can do it.
Well, that does seem like a good place to start. I guess if you have demonstrations just happening in little pockets, if you know where they're going to happen, and just like the Washington business, which seems pretty nasty, I heard that
yes.
quite a few of the protesters ended up in jail for a very long time.
But the protesters are extremely well organized. We are going to see, before the political conventions this year, we're going to see WTO, IMF, World Bank demonstrations that will paralyze both conventions, guaranteed. I am close to the attorneys who were defending those arrested in both Seattle and Washington, and these people are they have a leaderless kind of decision-making process, so that the government can target who they think are the leaders, and everything still goes on. This is a group consciousness evolution. There are, you know, and I, for one, am more optimistic than I have ever been, in spite of all the gadgets and whiz-bang devices that the government has right now.
Actually, I'm pretty much an optimist, too. There are so many avenues for information to get out, and people, even though they do have their everyday lives, they do listen. I mean, when you get your average person showing up at a protest, people who you wouldn't think would show up at something like that, and these people get outraged, well, they have a voice for a lot of years. And you affront them, something's going to happen at some point. There's always some kind of a karma. And I think you're right about the group consciousness. I don't know, but I've noticed a big difference in the 90s for people just noticing things.
Well, yeah. I think the Internet is going to really help this. I know they were broadcasting live from Washington, protesters, and they had their own website set up. I was down in Washington then, and I couldn't really believe the difference in what you'd see in the daytime there and what would appear on the CNN news. And it was like, you know, a small group of about 200 every day there, and a few were getting arrested, and police chief was out there trying to shake hands and whatnot. And then when you go down there and just see the busload after busload, you couldn't get a hotel in the city.
Right.
You know, I was just there to visit Fletcher, and it just turned out I didn't even know about the big protest rally ahead of time. And it was really unbelievable, the difference to what was reported. And
the reality.
Yeah, the reality. And another thing that I heard of was, you may have heard of this, a Dutch report about 6 months ago had reported that military personnel were doing internship at CNN.
Yes, and I saw that.
Yeah, I don't have the article in front of me or I quote from it, but just that kind of thing lets you know that they're really, as you say, they're controlling the satellites, but they're really getting a grip on the information.
Well, the ruling elite, which again is not monolithic, but the 1% who have accumulated so much wealth and are like a drunk on a bar stool, they just can't stop drinking and they're convinced they need more booze even long past the time when they're drunk, they must do everything possible to keep the myth going that we live under a rule of law, which we do not. Clearly in the Ed Wilson case, I've documented how that's not true, and a great many other things that are going on. And they must keep the myth going that everything is okay, that it's a healthy economy. All of these are great fallacies that are not true. And at some point, it really is like the old fable about the emperor's new clothes. Everybody's just kind of go, wait a minute, this is what they're telling us is not true. He doesn't have any clothes on, you know? And that point will come whenever it comes. Guys like me, there's an old saying that in a ham and eggs breakfast, the chicken is involved, but the pig is committed. I'm a pig. So I would do what I do anyway. And if we reach the point where we get to that 100th monkey and the change in consciousness occurs or not, I'll be doing what I'm doing. But I see a lot of changes, and I see them happening quickly, and the Internet's a great part of that.
Can you tell us more? You mentioned the Ed Wilson case.
Yes.
I'd like to hear a bit more about that, if you wouldn't mind informing those of us who aren't really up on this.
Well, back in the mid-70s, when George Bush was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Ed Wilson, a career CIA operative, left ostensibly, part of his cover, left the CIA in 1972 and set up his own company. And in 76, while Bush was CIA director, and a guy named Ted Shackley was the associate deputy director of operations, a legendary blonde ghost of Laos and Saigon and Allende fame, Wilson began, he opened business dealings with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And in 77, 78, he began selling Gaddafi sophisticated weaponry, thousands of timing devices for explosive devices. And then in 78, after Bush had left, but this was under the same basic plan, or 77, he shipped Muammar Gaddafi's 40,000 pounds of the plastic explosive C4. That's 20 tons. I mean, it's unbelievable amount of plastic explosives. As a matter of fact, it was the entire U.S. domestic supply of C4 at the time. Now, supposedly the agency didn't know anything about this. Well, he committed several other crimes, including weapons violations, and his partner, Frank Turple, did business, and they hired Green Berets for Gaddafi, who taught him how to make bombs shaped like ashtrays and radios and so on and so forth. Wilson was ultimately caught and captured, and of course, people like me and others have long believed that that was an agency plan from start to finish, that we have to arm enemies so that we have somebody to fight and somebody to justify asking for the budget. Wilson fell kind of afoul of the fact that Jimmy Carter won the election in 76, and another guy sat down at the floating crap game, so to speak, and Menachem Begin and the Camp David Accords became paramount. But the problem was that Gaddafi had vowed to kill Anwar Sadat, who was going to sign the Camp David Peace Accord. So the whole Wilson operation kind of tanked, was expendable. Wilson was ultimately arrested, I believe, in 1982. It was a big national world story. It was on Life magazine and People magazine and covered on 60 Minutes and every place under the sun. This renegade rogue CIA guy, this bad guy, and they caught him. And in Houston, they convicted him for sending the 40,000 pounds of plastic explosives to Gaddafi and sentenced him to 17 years, and that was in 83. Well, the research on this shows that, and it's been very clearly documented, and I've interviewed Wilson's attorney, David Adler, and had correspondence with Ed Wilson myself, but I've seen the documents. And you go back, and Ed Wilson was convicted in Houston strictly on the basis. His defense was, I was working for CIA, they knew what I was doing. And the CIA provided a memorandum signed by the CIA's executive director, Charles Briggs, the number three guy, who said, we have examined all of CIA records, and under no circumstances since he left CIA in 1972 has Mr. Wilson been asked to or provided directly or indirectly any services for the CIA or been asked directly or indirectly. I mean, it was clear, according to the CIA affidavit under oath, perjury, penalty of perjury, that the CIA said, we don't know anything about Ed Wilson, and he was convicted. Well, what has surfaced, and again, this is a bold move by the Clinton administration to declassify or release these documents in advance of an election, was that Wilson finally got Freedom of Information Act documents that showed that not only had the CIA perjured itself, and they put it in writing, because they had 80 documented examples where Ed Wilson had contact with or worked for the agency after 72, but that the Department of Justice, including the people who prosecuted Ed Wilson, including Assistant Attorney General, some very powerful people by the name of Stephen Trott, who is now a sitting judge on the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, was guilty to committing perjury to cover up the use of this perjured affidavit to get Wilson convicted. Another, D. Lowell Jensen, who was an Assistant Attorney General, is a sitting U.S. District Court judge in Oakland, California. Mark Richard, who was a Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the time, is still with the Justice Department. He oversaw Waco. Even though he protested, he kept his mouth quiet for 17 years over the use of a perjured document. There are some 7 or 8 of the most powerful lawyers in America. Clearly, on this paper trail, you read it, there is no question they committed perjury. And they committed a crime called misprision of perjury every day for 17 years that they didn't say anything for knowing that Wilson had been falsely convicted. There are now motions for a new trial in Houston. And Wilson's attorney, David Adler, who is a former CIA case officer, has also asked for contempt charges. But just reading these documents, you realize the fact that it was enshrined government policy. These guys didn't have any qualms about putting it in writing, saying, well, we know the affidavit wasn't true, but we think legally if we do this, nobody will say anything about it. And that's the way the government really works. The fact of what's amazing about this, though, is that the Clinton administration, or the Clinton faction, as I call it, was smart enough to have released these documents to Ed Wilson two years ago or so, actually three, I think, through his attorney, Bernard Fensterwald. These documents surfaced in time to become an issue that will allow Bill Clinton to fill 3 federal judgeships and possibly have a major scandal on some Republican powerhouses right before the election. And that's the way these guys plan this. I should add, too, that the general counsel for CIA, Stanley Sporkin, at the time, who was again a participant to the use of this perjured memorandum, became the sitting U.S. District Court judge in Washington, D.C. And he retired just days before the first motions in response from the Justice Department were filed in response to the motions for a new trial. And I should add at the same time that in the same week, a former CIA executive, Helene Boettner, drowned in a mysterious scuba diving accident in the Bahamas. She had been an aide to Madeleine Albright. But also, Admiral Stansfield Turner, the CIA director who immediately followed George Bush, was nearly killed in a very suspicious plane crash in Costa Rica. And this was all in the space of like 5 days of each other. You had these 3 key former CIA people, all of whom were connected to the Wilson case, having very strange events happen in their lives. Turner's wife was killed. He was brought back to the States. He was at Fort Sam Houston, I believe, in Texas at the military hospital there, subsequently brought back to Walter Reed in Washington. I believe he's out of the hospital now, but he was in a coma for a long time. That accident has been ruled pilot error, but who knows what it was at this point in time. But the Wilson case represents a huge potential scandal for the Republican Party, especially since Wilson's activities go directly back to George Herbert Walker Bush as director of CIA.
Wow. Well, it seems like an awful lot of stuff to be floating around there, sinking the Bush campaign. Do you think much of this is going to actually break in the media?
Well, you know, part of the way these battles are fought is not by what breaks in the media, but by what people can or could break in the media. That's the way the blackmail game is.
Blackmail, right.
So once these things start to surface through publications like mine, you got to remember I have 10 members of Congress and both intelligence committees read my newsletter. So even though when I write something, it doesn't necessarily go to the ABC Nightly News and 10 million people talk about it, I do know that when From the Wilderness publishes something, a lot of people go, oh my God, what's he writing about now? Because they know that it could be. And I have been in touch with, and I have been working with an AP correspondent on both the Ed Wilson story and on a very unique story, which is a lot of fun, where I have tracked an airplane, a Beechcraft King Air 200, a twin turboprop pressurized cabin, you know, kind of Cadillac Sportster airplane, that in 1982 was owned by drug smuggler Barry Seal, and it's now owned by the state of Texas, and it's one of Governor George W.'s favorite airplanes. And I have the ownership history of that airplane up on my website.
Well, some interesting friends he's got. As far as Ed Wilson goes, I understand he's got some connections to the Watchtower missions.
Bill Tyrie and I talk on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, I spoke with his attorney, Ray Coleman, just a few hours ago. As well as D. Caron Ferdinand, whose father, Albert Caron, was a bagman for George Bush and Oliver North. Much information there is on the website. Billy Tyrie is a former Special Forces troop who was involved in cocaine smuggling missions that CIA was running in the 70s, actually when George Bush was DCI, who was framed for the murder of his own wife in 1979. And he's been in prison ever since. And the Watchtower missions refer specifically to Ed Wilson and Task Force 57. I have queried Ed Wilson some on this, and I can't discuss anything about what I'm learning yet because I'm just not ready to go to print with anything yet. But again, see, all of these things weave back and forth. And what you see now is that, and as a matter of fact, I got some of this from Billy Tyree and from my other research, that we saw a major shift take place in the United States in the mid-70s. And I would love to hear what Fletcher has to say about this. In the, up until the early 70s, let's say 72, 73, toward the end of the Vietnam War, the U.S. economy was in effect subsidized. You know, we had a free gift in the form of very, very cheap oil, which allowed us to do things more cost-effectively at higher profit margins than other countries. But if I were to use the word cartel in 1973, 74, people would have thought of oil, not drugs.
Right.
Drug cartels didn't come into existence, so to speak, until the late 70s, early 80s. And what the Watchtower missions describe is the agency moving hundreds of tons of cocaine and prepositioning of that cocaine in Central America. Now, I was with LAPD in the mid-70s, and I was sent to a DEA training school in 1976. And what's funny is that the official position of the U.S. government in 1976 was that cocaine was less harmful than marijuana. The official U.S. government position was that cocaine was good for you, almost. You had guys testifying in Congress to that. And this was kind of interesting in that domestic consumption of cocaine, like in 76, 77, was maybe 10, 15 metric tons. Of course, by 1984, 85, U.S. domestic consumption of cocaine was 600 metric tons. And isn't it interesting that cocaine consumption remains stable at around 500 metric tons even today? In 1983, they seized 22 metric tons, and that didn't even raise the price. So something was setting us up for the huge cocaine epidemic, the explosion of cocaine use that took place in the 80s. And I believe that was a planned economic subsidy so that that money could be redirected into Wall Street in the form of cheap capital. And I lecture quite a bit at colleges and around the country, and just got back from Utah. And, you know, people get groups of 30 or 40 together, and I'll come do a talk. And what I do is, on a blackboard, I document how all these mega mergers on Wall Street are impossible unless the people doing the leverage buyout borrow laundered drug money to do it.
Well, that's quite the, I'd like to be able to see that sometime.
Well, I think what we're going to have to do is urge listeners to subscribe to your good newsletter.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've got all the documentary tributaries, as they say, to back that up. Because that's really only one way to explain it.
Yes. I mean, and as you know, if you've been to the website, I put lots of documents up there for people to look at. And when I publish in From the Wilderness, I've got sources all lined up for everybody. But when I do the chalk talk on the economy, it really makes things fall into place. Now, if anybody wants to subscribe, I can say that, to From the Wilderness, it's $35 a year. We publish monthly. Anybody who mentions Fletcher Prouty or your names will get 3 back issues for free. We have a secure server on the web at www.copvcia.com. We also have an 800 number, which is 800-META-911, META-911, 800-META-911. You can call us there. You know, we're open and available, and there's tons of documentation, lots of products, lots of material available, which actually goes hand in glove. I owe a great debt of gratitude to Fletcher Prouty's work for teaching me years ago how to think, so that when I came across this stuff, I could also, you know, start to figure it out. So the work here is very complimentary.
Yeah. We're going to archive this show on our website, and we'll make links to your site from there and keep them up. So we will have a good record for people who missed the show tonight, just to get a grip of the kind of things you've been talking about, and encourage people to go to your website and subscribe to From the Wilderness.
Great.
I know that I'm gonna.
Yeah, me too. You got two
Great.
New people right here.
Well, I want to thank all of you guys, especially all of our good friends in Canada. From the Wilderness has a great many subscribers in Canada, and also all the Fletcher Prouty fans. There's a lot to do here. We have a lot of documentation, and together we're building a map, and once you have the map, you can decide where you want to go.
Well, you're definitely good at being a road sign for some of us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Mike Rupert. And
very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I get the feeling that we could actually talk for hours to him, that we really just barely scratched the surface of what he knows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very articulate, too. And like you say, he draws a good map of what's going on. I've got to go back to the website and reread a few of those articles that I read. They kind of make a little more sense now.
Well, I was delving into one today. I didn't get very far, but the CIA's own documentation of CIA drug trafficking. You got to like that. His website is definitely worth checking out. Highly recommended.
Well, yeah, I imagine the, like, if he has discovered these documents, which I have no doubt, and they're out there, we need somebody to help go through the mess of documents that's been filtered and put out as, you know, just like you said, the documents he has at his website explain a lot.
Well, we get enough people. Everybody has their own little area where they specialize and passing information around. You just look what's happened since the internet has come up.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, you have some great researchers out there, or even were out there, people like Mae Brussel, who could, you know, correspond through newspapers, but I'll bet you that Mae Brussel would have loved to have the internet at her disposal.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to try to carry the torch for the people like that, Mae Brussel, Jim Garrison,
right,
and Fletcher. And it's good to be networked with Mike Rupert, because he really seems together and very focused on what he's been collecting, as he said, for at least 20 years.
Well, he has a lot of people that seem to be sending him stuff, and people in positions to know these things. So you're not just getting things, you know, hearsay through the friend of a friend, which makes a big difference.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.